Reset the podcast is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand. Whether it's low alcohol or no alcohol, Liars helps you enjoy your classic favourite cocktails.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset the podcast. A place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset. In this latest Reset the Podcast, I talked to Sue Uneman, a successful business author and senior woman in media. Her career is a hugely impressive one, but in this podcast, we talk more about her writing than we do her life at the media coalface. And there's good reason for that. Sue's three books act as a roadmap that describe her own personal journey. In discussing her first book, Tell the Truth, she tells me why she enjoys shooting down sacred cows. She explains why, in her second book, Glass Wall, she implores women to show off more. And in her third book, Belonging, she talks very passionately about why she believes that everyone should promise never to be a bystander. Three books with three fascinating themes, all told through the eyes of the woman who wrote them. So, keep listening. There are some great tips to learn. Sue, how wonderful to see you today. I'm delighted that you could join me on Reset the Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm very good, thank you. It's really good to see you. It's a long time since I've seen you, so it feels like a bit of, you know, normality creeping back in. The sun's shining. It's just lovely to be talking to you today.
I know it does make a lot of difference, doesn't it? And I'm so excited to talk to you because, so you've been in the industry, the marketing, the advertising, media industry for a long time, but you're also an author of three extraordinary books that I have loved. The first one, Tell the Truth, the second one, Glass Wall, and most recently, Belonging. So we're going to talk a little bit about you and how you've reset your life, but also some of the real learnings and resets in those books that people can follow. Let me start with you. First of all, you know, your life has been about communication. It's been in the industry. It's been about, you know, writing. What attracted you to the industry and marketing in the first place?
Well, I fell into it. And many people of my generation, I think, fell into media because we didn't really know about media. In fact, you know, people still don't know about media. It's very hard to explain to somebody who's outside the industry what your job is if you work in a media agency, because you say advertising and they go, oh, you make the ads, and you go, oh, no, we don't exactly make it. Sometimes we make some spot, but so it's complicated. I fell into it. I was heading for a law career, actually, and in my gap between a history degree and then going to the Inns of Court to do a course in law, I took a job in an ad agency as a TV buyer, just as a stopgap. And when it came for me to leave and go and do the law course, it basically was the choice for me as somebody in my early 20s between carrying on with the law course, carrying on living at home for another 2 or 3 years, or being able to afford to leave home. And my independence at the time was very important to me. And so I stayed in advertising. But I don't think that I really got advertising as a TV buyer until I moved from TV buying into media planning. When that happened, I really got, I guess, an enthusiasm for the role of a media planner in understanding and empathizing with consumers, understanding what it's like in people's real lives, and working out how to give your client a competitive edge in communicating better in media channels than the marketplace does. So once I started to do that, it was something that then all made sense to me.
So many people say that they've got a book inside them. Not many people actually get to writing it, let alone publishing it. And you've published three. What started that journey for you? Why did you decide to write initially Tell the Truth?
So it wasn't my idea. In fact, first two books weren't my idea at all, actually. I had created a book club for our clients at MediaCom, where we got great marketing speakers to come and speak. And one of them was a man called Jonathan Salem Baskin, who's an American author and works in our industry. And he'd written a book, which has still got a great title, called Branding Only Works on Cattle. And what he meant was that it's not just about branding, it's also about the whole experience, which is something that we talk about very much in marketing now, but people weren't talking about in those days. So we know absolutely that it's not okay for an ad to say we really care about our customers, and then for the experience on the website or the experience if you're trying to get in touch with them to be terrible, or for people being to be rude to you in the retail outlets or that kind of thing. But he'd written a book about this, and I invited him in to come and give a talk to our clients. And he did that. And then he said to me, "So Sue, tell me about your role." I was chief strategy officer at the time. So I talked to him about my role at MediaCom and what we did. And much of what we did, I would say, or our award-winning work that we were proud of, was to take an idea that was sitting in an advertising advert or in a brand and actually make it relevant to consumers. So I think, and we now say, you know, there's three approaches to media. There's reaching people with an ad, there's getting people to react in the right way, which might be performance marketing, but there's also relevance. How is it relevant? So I talked to him about the role that we did doing that. And he said, "This is really interesting, Sue," particularly at the time. So this is in the run up to 2012, so 2010, 2011, when we were really starting to see for the first time the impact of social media and e-commerce platforms on marketing. So as I used to say at the time to people, which you remember Woolworths, obviously, that Woolworths then existed. Right, well, when I walked into Woolworths and went to buy a product, people didn't come running up to me and say, "Oh, excuse me, Sue, actually, I've bought that product in the past. I've only given it 2 stars, right? Doesn't happen in a shop. It does, of course, happen when you go onto an e-commerce site like Amazon. So we were talking about the impact that that would have and what you should do about it. And that was the thought behind Tell the Truth, which was about American and US and UK examples of that.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, very interesting. And I think it brought to the fore, and I know that you have been described, I think Nick, your boss, talked to you about you're brilliant at shooting down sacred cows. Yeah. And in your book, Glass Wall, I think, and I remember at the time reading it and thinking, wow, this is a book that I can, one, really identify with, but also I was slightly amazed that so many other women had experienced things that I'd experienced that had similar feelings to me. Mm. And in some ways, I was quite surprised, but also it really helped me in that journey that I was experiencing at the same time. But it was very brave, I think, and you definitely shot down some sacred cows. What empowered you to be able to do that? Because I think that must have been quite hard.
Yeah, I think sometimes my desire to shoot down sacred cows overwhelms my fear of the impact of what I might do or say, actually. It's not always been a great career move. This book was also somebody else's idea. It was Nick Lawson in this case, who was my global CEO now, but I think was my EMEA CEO at the time. And I went to him and I said, you know, I'd love to do a follow-up to Tell the Truth. And he said, well, I'll support you in that, but that's not the book you should write. You should write a book about women at work. And at the time, Sheryl Sandberg had just published Lean In. And I thought, it's not such a great idea. She said a lot about it. And he said, well, think about it. So I did. And I thought about Lean In, which is a great book, but a book for extroverts, I think, predominantly. And as you know, I am very much an introvert. You know, I can act extrovert for a bit, but deep down, I'm an introvert. And I think when I was in my early 20s, if I'd read that and the insistence on putting your hands up and leaning in, I would have felt a bit intimidated. Probably would have gone back to bed. So I think that was the first impulse. The second impulse was MediaCom, as you know, is a highly successful agency. At the time, it was on its second woman CEO, Karen Blackett. Her exco was Just five people who were client-facing, four out of those five were women, three out of those four were working part-time. We had made it work. It's a highly competitive sector. I looked around the industry and I thought, well, what? So all the women who could have reached this level, they've all ended up at Theobald's Road, have they? Yeah. I mean, that's just not possible. And if you look beyond our sector, so not just media, not just advertising, but politics, law, into the city, you don't see that very often.
No.
And Mike, the question, the drive then became for me, why not? What is going wrong? What are businesses doing? Because they are therefore, if that talent is there and they are losing that talent or they are failing to promote that talent, that's a cost to them. And therefore, we wanted to write something that investigated that. So when I say we, I went to Catherine Jacob, who's CEO of Pearl & Dean, and I asked her to co-write this with me. We wanted to write something that disentangled what was holding women back, but also what was preventing businesses from developing and growing that talent. And it is gendered. We tried very much with the glass wall not to get into stereotypes, but one of the things, as you've said, that is gendered about the whole situation is that when a woman gets into a difficult situation at work, she is much more likely to think, oh, it's me, it's my bad, what have I done wrong? Not what's going on here. Is this something that's happened to many people? And is there actually a pragmatic way of sorting it out and getting through it? And yes. I think a lot of the diversity discussion is about how things should be. And how things should be is great. That doesn't deal with how things are. And somebody who is not benefiting from the current status quo, what you can do about it. And what we tried to do with Glass would be incredibly pragmatic.
And I love that. And it is interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, if I think back, my time at Centaur, where I worked with Andrea Vidler and Linda Smith, was the first and only time I've been on a board where there were more women than men. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time, and I loved it. It felt quite different, and actually not in a good or a bad way. It was very positive, but it doesn't mean that actually the environments I had where there were men were not positive. But I am interested, and I love the practicality about the book. You talked there about some of the challenges, and I like your point about saying, let's look at what is there, not what it ought to be. What kind of top tip did you come out of? And there's so many practical things, but what's the overriding theme for women to do to help themselves?
I think there's probably two things that I would pick out, apart from the one that made us famous. The one that made us famous was don't pour the tea.
Yes. But it's so true, isn't it? How many times have you sat in a room? I mean, it doesn't happen to me anymore because I'm obviously too old, but it's happened for years where everyone thought I was the PA and I would pour the tea because I blimey well did it.
You're very clearly the most important person in the room. Don't pour the tea. And I never pour the tea. And I've sat in meetings with, you know, perhaps one of the old school men of our industry, where he sat and looked at me, looked at his cup, looked at the teapot, and I've gone, you help yourself, mate. Yeah. So don't pour the tea. But I'd say there's two things. Women listen to the voices in their head that go, don't do that. I don't even know where they come from. I mean, they might come from parents or school or you know, so-called friends, but, you know, you're not good enough for this or you're not the best at that. Don't listen to the voices. Instead, try and talk to yourself as if you were talking to your best friend. So women are very good at saying to each other, no, but you'll be brilliant at that, and really bad at saying it to themselves. So if you can say it to your best friend, you can say it to yourself.
I love that. If you can say it to your best friend, you can say it to yourself. Yes. It's so important that we think about that and remember it. Yeah, I love that. Okay, that's the first one. The second one?
And then the second one is show off. Show off. You have to show off. Women are very ambivalent about showing off. Again, I think it's part of our upbringing. One of my favourite stories from the Glass Wall, which was told to me when I was interviewing, was a woman who was talking about her family. She was talking about going on a picnic with her. She had three kids, so two little twins who were just three, and then an older sister. And she said, we go on a picnic every year, about this time of year, actually, in spring, Bluebell Woods, round Easter time. The dads arrange an Easter egg hunt. So the dads go into the woods and hide the little Easter eggs, you know, there's little foil wrapped ones, and then the gold lint bunnies. And then the mum set out the picnic, and she said, you know, it's about 10 kids, and off they go, and they collect up the eggs and they bring them back to the picnic site and they share them out. And she said, except for this year, where the little boy, who I'm going to call Peter, because, as you know, all the names are disguised, mm-hmm. Peter was old enough to join in properly, and he came running back to the picnic site. He happened to be the only little boy, all the other children were girls, earlier than any of the other children, and he jumped into the middle of the picnic site, and you know, this woman, who I will call Jane, said to me, you know, everyone else was thinking, was everything all right with Peter? And Peter jumped into the picnic site, and he held up a gold lint bunny, and he said, I've won, Mummy and Daddy, I found the gold bunny. And there's this silence, and Jane says, I know what the other mothers are thinking. They're thinking, well, hang on a second, no one's ever won the Easter egg hunt before. And anyway, there's more than one gold lint bunny, you know, we don't know if he found the first one. So, but nobody says anything, no one wants to spoil his moment. And into this silence, Peter's dad speaks up, and Peter's dad goes, yes, Peter, that's right, you've beaten all the girls. Well done, Peter. And Jane said to me two things. She said, first of all, I do not think that if Peter's twin sister had done this, that's what the dad would have said. I think he, you know, she would have heard, oh, no, we're all sharing here. So it was like a very much a little boy directed thing. Yep. But secondly, she said, I realise that this is what goes on at work the whole time. She said, I, you know, it starts very young, but she's a consultant in a hospital. So, you know, very much, you know, we were talking about working in hospitals earlier, life and death experiences. And we think we're busy, right? They are very busy. They are genuinely busy. Mm. Said, if my boss passes me in the corridor and says, how are things going? I don't want to trouble him. So I'll go, everything's fine. Don't worry. She said, I realise that if he passes one of my colleagues who is a man and says to him how things going, he is more likely to say, everything is fine now. There was a huge crisis, but I solved it. Don't worry about it. And I think this is going on day in, day out in our industry. I think that women are talking about what we've achieved as a team, and men are talking about how they've solved huge problems. And I think unless you listen out for it very carefully, and this is where it's important for managers to change how they behave and leaders to change how they behave, as well as women who are, or anybody who's disadvantaged, so it needs to change and show off more, find a way of showing off. But also, you know, for any leader out there, who do you want to promote into the next position? Someone who's very good at getting promoted, very good at showing off, or someone who's very good at the job into which you're going to promote them. Yeah. These are not the same things. And I don't know about you, but I will fess up. I've not always seen the difference.
No. And I completely agree. And the other bit that I think is hard is I get the showing off bit, and I try and help people do it all the time. But then I was doing a speech, actually not that long ago, and it was to a European group, quite a large group, and a lot of men. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do my showing off bit, a little bit. You know, I'm, you know, in comparison to what they would be like, kind of nothing. And one of the feedback comments was, this was not very good. All she did was show off. And it really cut me. And loads of the other comments were very lovely and supportive, and they found it really interesting. But it ate into me I had to stop myself, I think, and go, look, they thought I was showing off. I think that's because I'm...
No, a person thought you were showing off. You had 20 great compliments, but the one that stayed with you, and that's another thing. Right? It's kind of like, no, take the praise. It's almost like we've got heat-seeking missiles in our brain that are going for the criticism. Like,
yes,
you're fantastic at all of these things, but sometimes, you know, sometimes I think that you sometimes don't always, aren't always perfect. And it's like, what? What do you mean? It's like,
I know.
And we're like that. And I think men seem to come into the workplace better equipped to avoid that. And honestly, most workplaces are still designed for and by men.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're so right. And that kind of unconscious bias that we have ourselves, which is terrible, but also for the, and that's sort of, I mean, that's so interesting, isn't it? And that does bring us on to maybe your third book, which is about belonging. And what struck me again was that sense that, and certainly for me at the beginning of my career and at various times now, I went to drama school, I didn't feel that I belonged. I felt very different. There was times in my advertising career where I just felt I wasn't the right person I wasn't myself. Tell me about why you wanted to write about belonging.
Part of the reason that we wrote about belonging was because at the end of our Glasswall talks, and Glasswall was a bestseller, and we gave over 150 talks, Catherine and I, and a question started to come up at the end of the talk, whereby one of the women in the audience, and the audiences would be predominantly women, would put up a hand and say, I've got a question now. It's not for Sue and Catherine, it's for the organisers of the talk, looks around the room. Can I just say, where are all the men? And the organisers of the talk would say, well, it's International Women's Day, or yes, it's the Women's Network, or it's, you know, our high-flying women, you know.
Initiative. All the best women in the world, things coming together.
Yeah. And if there was a man there, he might go, well, we weren't really sure that we were invited. And of course, you know, in a physical space, there's only so many chairs. We didn't want to take, you know, spaces away from women. That's not right. And then the woman who asked the question would say, okay, but if we're only talking to ourselves, exactly how is anything going to change? And we thought, oh my goodness, that's so powerful.
Yes.
And although we'd written the Glasswall for managers of every gender, as well as for women on the way up, we thought two things at that point. We thought, first of all, we need a book that firmly addresses the people who are currently in power. And that at the moment predominantly is still straight white middle-aged men, just statistically. And there's still only 11 women on the FTSE 100. And even though the proportion of NEDs on the FTSE, so the proportion of directors overall on the FTSE 100 that are women is now, you know, over a third. Most of those women are non-executive directors. They don't actually work for the businesses for which they are represented. And the number of women executive directors on FTSE 100 boards is just 2%. So also, you know, I'm a media person. I like digging into the data.
But it's, and just for 1 second to pause on that, is still terrible. And we all know the, you know, reasons, excuses, you know, maybe positive reasons why people just don't want to take those roles. But 2% and even a third of NEDs, it's only a third.
Yes.
We're terribly pleased with ourselves. It's a third. It's like, guys, you know, this is, we are
50%.
Half the population, not a third of the population. So, yeah, sorry. Let's carry on.
So, no, absolutely right. So it felt to us, and particularly after we'd done conversations with, again, went over out and did over 100 interviews, and we've got quant research again. But we spoke to a number of CEOs who were straight white middle-aged men who said, do you know what, Sue, I'm very enthusiastic about diversity. I think it's very important. But I don't have any women on my board at the moment, or I just have one woman on my board. I can't really find them. I haven't got the right experience. I've got some very good men. I don't want to get rid of the men on my board. Yeah, okay, but I've got a very good woman on my board, and she's, guess what, sorting out the pipeline. At which point, okay, all right, you're sorting out the pipeline. That's good. That's great. You know, and beyond gender to all forms of underrepresented groups. That's fantastic. But exactly how is sorting out the pipeline going to change your board? Because the entry level pipeline at a lot of businesses has been heavily populated by women for a long time. You know, women do better at graduating. So they very often do in a lot of businesses, they get a lot of those entry-level jobs. And yet that hasn't changed the makeup of the board. So first of all, that's a stalling, that's a status quo kind of type comment. And it's not okay to delegate this, I think, at all. I mean, I think, you know, it's a cultural issue for the whole business, which is what we talk about in the culture of belonging. But also in addition, they would say, and the reason why I'm not front and center of this myself is the chances of me doing or saying the wrong thing, even slightly, are so high and so terrifying that the consequences could be career ending. I say the wrong thing, that could be the end of my career. Yeah. And we thought this was really interesting, that the inclusion industry, diversity and inclusion industry, on which is spent over £6 billion a year, have created an environment that excludes the very people who are currently in power. Yes. That can't help. So what we've tried to do with belonging is to paint a picture and be very practical about the steps that anybody in an organization needs to take to create that culture of belonging. And also to be really clear that if you are one of those men in power and you're sitting in a boardroom, it is your job to open the door for other types of people, and that it's not a zero-sum game. If you do so, the business will succeed and the business will grow.
And so I think what's the, I mean, that's so interesting and really helpful. And again, I love the practicality of it. But, you know, if there are people listening today, what's the one thing that people could do differently tomorrow to gender that sense of belonging, to make that change happen?
Please don't wait for tomorrow. Do it today. And what they can do is promise never to be a bystander again. So one of the shocking statistics in the book is that one in three people have experienced bias, harassment, or inappropriate behaviour at work. Over one in three people have witnessed this kind of behaviour. And in the marketing community, because we have statistics for the marketing community in the UK, marketing and PR, so broadly, nearly half, but over 40% of people have witnessed this kind of behaviour. Now, if when you see any kind of behaviour like this, and that could be a very small microaggression, or it could be somebody using banter as an excuse for actually quite a painful put down. If you said something, if you championed the person that is experiencing a sense of feeling excluded because of that behaviour, and if you found a way of addressing it, then I think our industry could change overnight. Because I do think that all over the place, that's still going on. And most of the time, we just are embarrassed or fearful in the moment to do or say anything. So I'm not saying it's easy, but it's something that every single one of us can do.
And you're right, it's not always easy. And I think we've all been in that place. Can you talk about a personal experience that you've had where you've experienced that, and maybe when you have or even haven't spoken out, that in reflection now you would?
Yes, I mean, I back to the shooting status sacred cows. I am a speaker outer. In fact, sometimes I speak out when it can have a balance. So I was in a conversation, and the person that I was in a conversation with actually mentioned this to me the other day. So obviously it stuck with him quite a lot. And it was somebody who was talking to me about a change of culture in his team. And he was saying, you know, it's much more even now, you know, everybody gets a chance to speak up. We don't mind who speaks up in meetings. We really don't mind if it's the men or if it's the girls. And I said, that just jarred with me. And I said, just, well, the men or the women. And it was a it was a big moment. I mean, he hadn't realized what he'd said. He'd intended to say something positive, and I'd called him up on it. And I was aware that it was a bit of a moment. And I did discuss it with a friend privately, who said to me, look, he was trying to explain that things had got better. Did you really have to say something? And I thought, yeah, actually, I really did have to say something.
Yeah.
And he talked to me a few years ago, he talked to me about it the other day. And he said, it just made me realise that the person that I come across as isn't necessarily how I'm seen by people that don't know me that well, which I think is something that we all need to bear in mind. But secondly, the fact that he is quite just as likely to call the men in his team the boys as he is to call women the girl. I think there might be a rule, though, Suki. I don't know what you think. I think men should not call women girls, even if they call themselves girls. I think it was a juxtaposition between the grown-up men and the little girls. That's how it came across to me in that moment. But I did think about it afterwards, because I think it sets back our relationship in the short term, but not in the long term.
Yes, and that's so interesting. I'm now thinking about that, because I think I do use the expression girls, but I definitely don't mean it in a non-positive way. But I do absolutely get your point about saying men and girls is not equal. And so anything that kind of reinforces that lack of equality goes completely against everything we're trying to do. So and I also think you're right. Often speaking out does, for a moment or even a long moment, makes people take a deep in, take a breath, and might be difficult or awkward, but invariably it does make it a better relationship, or it probably wasn't the relationship you think you had in the first place, which
I think that's a really good point. And I do think, I mean, at Mediacom, we're doing lots of work on this. So we created a microaggressions video where we talked about what a microaggression was and also how frequent they are, even in places that consider themselves to have a good culture, they happen. We also did a microaggressions workshop and then training. And the thing that we talk about in the book, which I think we all need to practice more of. So I think, first of all, I'm going to mention something that's come out that was a positive step after the terrible tragedy and murder of George Floyd last year, which is that the New Orleans Police Force adopted a program which was actually invented by a professor of why violence happens, who himself is a Holocaust survivor, which is quite interesting. And it's called EPIC, Ethical Policing is Courageous. And the point that this professor made, and I think it's very important for our leadership training, actually, because you've done leadership training, right? I've done leadership training. I've never been trained in this. So the point that he made is that when police get trained in the US, they get trained how to stop somebody, being violent or killing somebody or killing each other, right? That's what they get taught. They never, ever, ever, and with all the adrenaline flying and or imagined guns, as it is sometimes. What they never get taught is how to stage an intervention with each other or how to take that criticism when they are in that moment themselves. And if you think about the leadership training that we do, we don't either, right?
No.
I've never done a module that goes,
no,
here's how to take a criticism when somebody pulls you up. Or also, when Sue's in full flow, here's how you interrupt her.
Yes.
And I think that might be something that's missing out of our industry. So I would love to see that as an ad.
Yes, I think that's a very, very interesting way to think about it. Look, thanks, Sue. Just finally, that we've talked about lots of resets and lots of moments when people can reset themselves. But we're also very much about well-being and physical and mental well-being. What do you do and what have you done in the last year to keep yourself physically, mentally robust?
So I do quite a lot, actually, and I've done more in the last year because I've had the opportunity to, because I'm not having such a long commute. So I meditate every day and I would highly recommend it to everybody. I mean, if you can find 15, 10 minutes even in a day, it can change your whole mindset for the day. And for me, it's now like cleaning my teeth. I wouldn't get dressed without it. I do it in the morning. But I exercise. So I've been going for walks. I've been obviously not going to classes or going to the gym, but I've discovered the joys of exercising with online trainers.
Yeah.
And I think, and this is also can be gendered, is I'm 5'2". So one of the very leveling things about Zoom calls is you can't tell how tall I am. That's one of the benefits. I'm 5'2", and when I reached teenage years, I think I was discouraged by my school from entering into sports, basically. I was going to teenage
development. So many women, that's happened to so many women.
But nobody wanted me. I mean, it's like, I think I was in the B team for netball for one term and then I got dropped. because I just wasn't tall enough. And it took me a long time to realise that I am so much happier if I'm physically exercising. And so that's been, yeah. And I'm not an Iron Man woman, whatever. I don't do anything manic, but just the getting out of the house, getting fresh air. That's been a great joy, actually, of the pandemic, which has been so terrible in so many ways.
Yeah. No, and that's lovely to hear, because I think it's so true. And, you know, if you can have that routine, as you say, it's like brushing your teeth. It's so brilliant for us to be able to focus on our day and get more out of it. Thank you, Sue. Look, it struck me, we talk about shooting down sacred cows. You have done that in so many brilliant ways. I love the fact that during our conversation, you remind us that you are an introvert, because so often we think about people that make really significant contribution, write, speak, as very extrovert people. And if we're not like that, that perhaps we can't make a difference. But I think that you've shown to me, to everyone listening, that you don't have to be somebody who is an outgoing extrovert to make a difference. You just need to be someone who has a passion for change, who wants to be brave to speak out, but also who's prepared to be authentic and vulnerable and tell not only their story, but other people's stories as well. So thank you so much for sharing your story with me today.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. And hope to see you in real life soon.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed Reset the Podcast, I'd love it if you would forward it to your work colleagues, friends and family. Reset the Podcast is a Let's Reset and Advertising Week global production. Executive producer is Richard Larson, with me, Suki Thompson. Thanks to our sponsor, Liars Non-Alcoholic Spirits, and voiceover artist, Talitha Penny. Music provided by Audio Network.